Today is January 8th, 2021, and it has been one crazy week. On Tuesday, Georgia held its special election, and thanks to Stacey Abrams and organizers of color in the South, we flipped the Senate blue, nominating Reverend Raphael Warnock as Georgia's first black senator. If you listen to our intro episodes, you'll know that we did an entire episode about Shabbat by way of deconstructing Abraham Joshua Heschel's book, The Sabbath. If you haven't, I highly recommend doing so. It's a great conversation. And so, along with all the other reasons, I was deeply moved by Senator Warnock's interview he held with CNN from Atlanta on Wednesday morning, where he references Heschel. I'd like to actually play a little clip of that now.
We are sending an African-American man, the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, where Martin Luther King Jr. served and John Lewis worshiped. And John Ossoff, a young Jewish man, the son of an immigrant, mentored by John Lewis, to the United States Senate in this moment in which, for years now, we've seen an emergence of those forces that would seek to divide us. We now represent the state of Georgia. I think Abraham Joshua Heschel, the rabbi who said when he marched with Dr. King, he felt like his legs were praying. I think he and Dr. King are smiling in this moment, and we hope to make them proud.
Shortly after that interview, emboldened by Rudy Giuliani, seditious Senators Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, among other congresspeople, and most critically by the president himself, a mob of white armed domestic terrorists stormed the U.S. Capitol building in an attempted coup with seemingly little repercussion. Videos quickly surfaced of police taking selfies with the intruders, police holding people's hands while helping them down the steps to exit the building, and very few arrests were made. Now, I've been to protests. I spent 3 months at the Standing Rock Reservation during the standoff against Dakota Access Pipeline and witnessed law enforcement employ flash bombs, rubber bullets, and high-powered water hoses in freezing temperatures. I've been at Black Lives Matter protests where unarmed folks practicing their First Amendment rights were beaten and bloodied, arrested, and thrown into cages by NYPD. All to say, had the intruders on Wednesday been black or brown, there's no doubt the outcome would have been different. So to remark that we as a country have failed to reckon with white supremacy is an understatement. As a note, we recorded this episode before the unrest at the Capitol, so we won't be covering it in today's discussion. This week, we begin the book of Exodus, one of history's oldest texts about liberation. Liberation from oppressive rulers, oppressive systems, and oppressive beliefs. In my mind, there is no better person to help us unpack these themes than Dr. Melina Abdullah, co-founder of Black Lives Matter LA and chair of the Department of Pan-African Studies at California State University, Los Angeles. To be honest, when we started conceiving this show, Dr. Abdullah was the first person I thought of as a dream someday guest. Well, that day is today, and I think you'll see why. It's hard to express the profound effect that Dr. Abdullah has had on Los Angeles the past few years. As a community leader and professor, it was her leadership, along with the organizers of BLMLA, that ousted Jackie Lacey, our last district attorney. Dr. Abdullah hosted weekly protests outside of the Los Angeles Department of Justice offices for years, gaining media attention, growing in numbers, and finally success when LA voted Lacey out this past November in what some considered the most profound change in criminal justice reform in the country. You'll hear Dr. Abdullah talk about the DA race a bit, and I just want to be explicitly clear that she is responsible for this incredible win. This past year, through her work as a professor, Dr. Abdullah successfully petitioned for all California state universities to include an ethnic studies course as graduation requirement, and we'll discuss what role education has in rebalancing the scales of injustice. Today's show might honestly be one of the most important conversations I've had the pleasure of hosting. And that the beginning of Exodus lands on a week when we've both had an attempted coup and made Mitch McConnell the Senate minority leader is an incredible reminder that democracy is a living and breathing process. So don't go anywhere. I'm Raviv Ullman, and welcome to The Study. It is a true honor to be able to study some Torah with and welcome to the show Dr. Malina Abdullah. Dr. Abdullah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we have so much ground to cover today, and I can't wait to begin the book of Exodus with you and Rabbi Adam. But I'd love to start where we actually ended last week's episode, which was about looking back in order to move forward. I've had the great opportunity to be at many marches and protests and teach-ins that you've led. And on a personal note, hearing you and Janaya and Kendrick and so many others speak at a time where it felt like there was hardly any leadership anywhere, whether locally or on a national level, it was just incredible to hear what actual leadership sounded like. So thank you. But you always start each session with libations, quite literally pouring one out. So I was wondering if, to set us off on the right foot, could you talk a bit about libations, about saying the names of the dead, and the role that those practices play in your movement?
Yeah, and thank you. And this whole concept of looking back in order to look forward, in order to move forward, is also an indigenous African belief, spiritual belief that we call Sankofa. It's represented visually by a bird who's moving forward and his head is turned completely backwards and it's picking up an egg from the rear, right? And so it's a concept that cuts through, I think, many different spiritual practices and, of course, is fundamental to the pouring of libation. We understand that as spiritual beings, the energies that move us towards justice are not just energies that exist in physical form. So it's not just the people that you can see. It's not just those of us who are gathered together in body, but there's also spiritual energy that moves us forward. And for African descended people in particular, it's the spiritual presence that has made us victorious through struggles that seem impossible, seem insurmountable. So, you know, the ending of chattel slavery, where our ancestors were literally treated as not human, who were treated as, in some cases, less than animals, right? How did we upend that system of chattel slavery? It wasn't because, you know, the physical kind of presence of our people won it. It was also the invocation of spiritual energy and the spiritual practices of those who dared to struggle. So we begin every Black Lives Matter gathering, every Black Lives Matter action, every Black Lives Matter meeting with a pouring of libation, which is an indigenous African practice that's shared by other cultures around the world, but it's primarily indigenously African. And it's the pouring of liquid into earth. It's the feeding of that spiritual energy. And by feeding of that spiritual energy, I want to be very clear that what we mean by that is that when bodies are stolen, when bodies no longer exist, the spiritual energy continues, right? So sometimes when we think about the way in which we function in the world and, you know, the way in which we function in our families, sometimes we'll call on the energy of our grandmothers, right? Or our grandfathers. And I think all of us do this, right? If grandma was here, she would, you know, and that's really what the pouring of libation is recognizing that, you know, our grandmother's spirits are still here, right? So for New Year's, we have Black people in this country have what we call good luck food, right? Which really is a carryover from Africa. And so Black people everywhere in this country, we all eat the same thing on January 1st, black-eyed peas and collard greens, right? And usually we eat it with cornbread. This year, you know, as I was preparing our good luck food for my household, I thought about how fortunate I am that I grew up across the street from my great grandma and that I'm very comfortable cooking. And as I'm cooking what we call soul food, right? Soul food, right? That I'm also invoking the spirit of Grandma Cox, who is with me in the kitchen. And so this is a long answer to the pouring of libation. When we pour libation, we're acknowledging our grandmother's presence. We're acknowledging the freedom fighters who walked before us, Mama Harriet Tubman, Charlotta Bass, so many others, Frederick Douglass, right? We're acknowledging the presence of people like Malcolm X, and in Los Angeles, even our recent freedom fighters, people like Didon Kamathi, and unknown names like Marcus Macapone Higgins, who are known to his community but might not be ever written in the name of a history book, right? We're also acknowledging those on whose behalf we struggle. So for Black Lives Matter, it should be apparent, but it took us a moment to recognize that this is absolutely a spiritual movement, that when we hashtag names, we're literally invoking the spirits of those on whose behalf we struggle. So when we pour a libation, when we pour water into earth, right, as part of our libation practice, when we pour that water, we say the names A.J. Weber, the 16-year-old boy who was murdered on Super Bowl Sunday by L.A. County sheriffs, right? We say the name Dejan Kizzee, who was just murdered by L.A. County Sheriff a couple months ago. We say the name Waukesha Wilson, who was killed by LAPD as she was in custody at L.A. Police Metro Detention Center. And so we acknowledge them and we invoke their spirits so that our struggle can be both righteous and victorious.
That was just so powerful, Dr. Abdullah. Thank you so much. And it really feels like that's what we're doing together or striving to do together in this study, is going back not just to our grandmothers, but to their grandmothers and their grandmothers and their grandmothers, all the way back to the first stories of our people, and to recognize that the struggles that they went through and the path that they charted for us continues to light our way thousands of years later, that the past isn't really past. The past is with us in a continuous way if we bring it to mind. And I'm so grateful for the way that you framed that. I feel like that could be a spiritual intention for Raviv and I moving forward with this whole project, not just with this episode. So I want to thank you for that. And to say that we're embarking now together on the second book of the Torah, the book of Exodus, which is one of the most enduring paradigmatic stories of liberation that exists in our shared canon. So there is no better time to be in this conversation in terms of the year of annual Torah readings than right now.
I was regretting that I don't have a pen. I love how you framed that the past isn't really past. I love how you framed that. Absolutely.
So Dr. Abdullah, before we get into the thick of things, for our listeners who don't have a clear definition of what Black Lives Matter is, including its mission and your role in it, would you mind talking just for a moment about that for us?
Sure. So Black Lives Matter is quite simply a movement that was built to end state-sanctioned violence against Black people. It is a Black-led and ally-supported movement that is abolitionist in its approach, meaning that we understand that the structures that were built were deliberately designed to produce the outcomes that they do. And so while we support meaningful reform, we also want to be imaginative in our approach to justice and recognize that as we talk about justice and safety and freedom, it requires the building of new structures. And so abolitionism means a willingness to upend systems that don't serve us. But the second half of abolitionism is also building new systems, building liberatory systems.
Well, within that context of having someone with us who has been a leader in the activist movement, Rabbi Adam, could you summarize this week's Parsha with perhaps a specific focus on Moses' struggle to become an activist?
Yeah, so let me just set the context. I don't think that it's an exaggeration to say that the events recorded in this Parsha in particular that underlie the whole book of Exodus form one of the most consequential stories of liberation in all of human history. We start with this Parsha with the Israelite tribe having relocated to Egypt on account of a famine. A few generations pass, and this new, hardline, deeply xenophobic ruler comes to power. A pharaoh who, it said, does not remember Joseph, does not remember the way in which the Israelites were once welcomed into the community. He orders the Israelites enslaved, and when that does nothing to curb their population growth, he pivots to a policy of genocide, targeted specifically at their sons. Their boys are to be taken away by the authorities and drowned in the Nile River. It's the heroism in the early part of this Parsha of women who fight back. Shifra and Pua, two Egyptian midwives, are engaged in what I believe to be the first recorded act of civil disobedience, covertly saving Israelite babies and lying to the authorities that they were stillborn. And then it's a mother and a sister who work together to save their baby brother Moses, baby son, baby brother, a boy who will grow up in the Egyptian palace, adopted by yet another courageous woman, the daughter of Pharaoh himself. Moses is raised as an Egyptian prince with all of the privilege in the world, but he eventually learns his origin story and can no longer tolerate the cruelty that his people are subjected to. He flees Egypt and encounters in his wandering God at a burning bush, who tells him to go back to Pharaoh and demand that he let his people go. The confrontation that gets set up here between the demands of justice and the cruelty of unchecked tyrannical power sets the theme for the whole rest of this book. And I'd really argue for the Jewish tradition of social justice and many other social justice traditions informed by Western literature, and for this really timely conversation about confronting the pharaohs of today.
Adam, can you talk a little bit more about the role that the nonviolent protest plays in this Parsha, whether it's Shifra and Pua or Pharaoh's daughter? Why is it the women who carry out nonviolent protest here?
I mean, I think if you want to start a revolution, it's always makes sense to start with women. Female-identified people have been at the forefront of every movement of social change that I can imagine. And it's really very clear, you know, in the first couple of chapters of Exodus, all of the active players here are female. It's Shifra and Pua, the midwives. It's the mother and sister of Moses, not his father and brother. It's the daughter of Pharaoh who adopts a member of this despised and enslaved and targeted for murder race and raises him under the nose of her father, the tyrant who is carrying out this policy. There's all sorts of examples in the beginning of this Parsha of conspiring against tyranny and doing what is possible in small ways to fight back. And then, you know, the later part of the Parsha sets up what's going to be the larger confrontation, which is going to be this confrontation between Moses and Pharaoh with the demand that a invisible spiritual force, a God who Pharaoh has never known, is on the side of an enslaved people rather than on the side of the most powerful leader of the ancient world. I think if any single thing from this Parsha is the most profound contribution to the conversation. It's this idea that God can be on the side of justice rather than power. Because so many cultures have constructed the story, and so many people continue to construct the story that might makes right, and that those who are in power must have God on their side, so to speak. And instead, the story inverts those power relationships and says, God is on the side of this people who is facing destruction, not on the side of all of the wealth and force and glory that was Egypt. That a campaign being waged by midwives and slave women could ultimately overthrow the world's most powerful empire and force it to yield. That set up a dynamic of what it means to agitate for good.
It feels like one of the themes that begins here in Exodus is, like you're saying, Rabbi Adam, the power of our voice. The Israelites had to call for change, otherwise they would have remained enslaved. And on this point, I'd like to compare two quotes. The first one is written in James Joyce's Ulysses, which writes, "Had the youthful Moses listened to and accepted the Egyptian view of life, had he bowed his head and bowed his will and bowed his spirit, he would never have brought the chosen people out of their house of bondage." And another is by you, Dr. Abdullah. You once wrote, "I think it's really important that you understand your own power, that you don't have to accept the world that you live in, that all of your most radical imaginings, all of your innate senses of fairness and right and wrong can come to pass if you're willing to fight for those things." Dr. Abdullah, would you talk a little bit about the power of our voice and the changes that you've seen take place in using your own?
Sure. Well, I really appreciate that reading. And I really appreciate, I hadn't thought about it in terms of gender before. So I think, Rabbi, that was really powerful for us to think about how gender births these kinds of revolution. Women birth these kind of, wow, women birth, of course women birth, right? Women birth these revolutionary movements. And although they're not always, we're not always seen as the revolutionaries, it really is birthed through us. And I've read Exodus many times, but I've never thought of it in terms of gender. So I appreciate that. Exodus has so much application right now, right? When we talk about Pharaoh, when we talk about power versus justice, right? This is what we've been looking at for the last 4 years and before, but especially in really stark terms over the last 4 years, power versus justice. And I think that one of the chants that we always say at our gatherings and at our demonstrations is that when we fight, we win. And as you were reading from Exodus, I kept thinking, and as you were talking about like Pharaoh versus Moses, right? Well, if God is on the side of Moses, why is Pharaoh in power, right? If God is all powerful, right? Why is not justice in power? And I think that there is something, and I'm thinking and talking at the same time, which is a terrible idea, so I hope this makes sense. I think that there's something to be won from the struggle itself, right? That if justice is always in power, then we kind of take justice for granted. And I don't think that we grapple enough with what justice is. Like, I think that having to struggle for justice gives it value. If your kids came into the world perfect, you wouldn't really appreciate your kids completely, right? The kids are the greatest struggle, right? And so we have to struggle. It's struggle that's valued, and it's struggle that makes, without struggle, there is no victory. And so I think that what I was saying is that part of our work in this world is grappling with that conflict and contrast and tension between power and justice. Where is power out of sync with justice, and how do we make sure that justice wins? And how do we commit our lives and our resources and our energies and our spiritual practices to the struggle for justice? So what I was trying to say is that where we see injustice, we have a sacred duty to struggle for justice with everything that we have.
There does appear to be an analogous relationship between the Israelites' life under bondage and then liberating themselves, and the radical uptick in the number of people congealing into effective movements in the immediate wake of George Floyd's murder, whereby millions came to understand and enact their own power, rejecting the status quo of systemic racism, white supremacy, police brutality, and class oppression, among so much more. And there's the biblical explanation for the Israelites' empowerment. But Dr. Abdullah, what's your explanation for the upswell of mass mobilization against the oppressive systems in this country? How did so many people overcome self-doubt and the associated feeling that nothing they did could ever matter?
Yeah, not to mention a pandemic, right, that told us literally to stay in the house. So there's several different answers. One is, as we talk about the pouring of libation and spiritual energy, I don't know who George Floyd was in life, but it's extremely apparent that he has a tremendous spirit that was able to ignite us. He is not the first Black man to be killed on camera, right? He's not the first murder that we've seen. And so there was something about his spirit that spoke to us. And we can think about that in many different ways. I'm not saying he's the only spirit to have ever spoken to us. We can think about how Trayvon's spirit ignited the Black Lives Matter movement, right? We can think about how Breonna Taylor's spirit continues to live with us. But George Floyd's spirit was something that spoke to people differently. I think that also, you know, there was the piece about the world slowing down, us being at home during a pandemic, and many of us having stay-at-home orders meant that we couldn't look away, right? Mm-hmm. That we had to watch. We couldn't pretend that we didn't know. We couldn't pretend not to have seen the whole 8 minutes and 46 seconds where Derek Chauvin made the constant decision to steal George Floyd's life, right? He had 8 minutes and 46 seconds to change his mind, right? And he refused to. And I think many of us saw the horror and inhumanity in that. I think that there was also just this moment in the universe. And I say it's a moment when the world cracked wide open, right? That there was just a recognition that this tinkering, this pretending that the systems under which we live are fair is a lie. And that if we're to move forward and all of these things kind of converge, right? So you got the pandemic, you got the economic fallout, and you got the constant murder of Black folks, right? It's, are you going to swallow it? Are you going to, now I'm thinking about, see, I don't have the Exodus committed to memory, but are you going to accept that Pharaoh is not going to let your people go? Or are you going to say, no, whatever it takes, braving a pandemic, braving police violence, and I want to be clear, Black people braving a pandemic when we were most likely to be killed by the health pandemic, right? That we recognize that the murder of Black people at the hands of the state is also a pandemic, right? And so for me as a mother, to value the lives of my three children means I have to brave the so-called immediate health pandemic so that I can undo structures that target my children, right? That we have to brave whatever Pharaoh has at his disposal in order to upend a fundamentally unjust system. So that's what I think happened. I think that also one of the things that was unique in this moment is that I mentioned Black Lives Matter is a Black-led and ally-supported movement, that non-Black folks were forced to kind of look in the mirror and say, are we going to sit by and watch the knee in the neck of George Floyd and act like nothing is happening? Or are we going to stand up also? And I think that one of the things that gives me hope is that so many non-Black folks also joined the constant courage and action and activism and organizing of courageous Black folks and said, we're not going to have you struggle alone because our freedom is bound up with yours.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Friday Night with One Table is all about feeling good. And they're here to help you hold that magic of Shabbat while protecting the health and safety of one another. It's a difficult and isolating time. But even when you're alone, Shabbat is a built-in reminder to do something for yourself that provides the respite needed to enter the next week. Plus, One Table helps out with small financial gifts so you can make sure it's extra special. Head to onetable.org to see how you can connect to the experience of Shabbat in a way that is new and, perhaps surprisingly, sacred. It feels like one of the systems of oppression that we talk about is justice by way of the courts. And I want to read another quote. This is more quote reading than I've ever done on this show, so bear with me. But the rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, who is a favorite of ours here on the show, in dialogue with Martin Luther King, wrote, "Righteousness must dwell not only in the places where justice is judicially administered. There are many ways of evading the law and escaping the arm of justice. As a rule, those who know how to exploit are endowed with the skill to justify their acts, while those who are easily exploited possess no skill in pleading their own cause. Those who neither exploit nor are exploited are ready to fight when their own interests are harmed. They will not be involved when not personally affected. Who shall plead for the helpless? Who shall prevent the epidemic of injustice that no court of justice is capable of stopping?" Now, we could enumerate the near infinite number of cases not tried against police officers who have murdered, for example, or the many cases where police receive no more than a slap on the wrist. But instead, I'd like to speak about the structure of which those failures of justice are symptoms. From your perspective, Dr. Abdullah, why has the judicial system failed the oppressed in this country, specifically as of late, and even in cities that purport to be progressive, like Los Angeles?
Dr. Yusuf Salam of the Exonerated Five, which was once known as the Central Park Five, calls it the criminal system of injustice. We have to stop calling it the criminal justice system, right? Mm-hmm. And Manny Marable writes about this in How Capitalism Underdeveloped Black America, that these systems were deliberately and intentionally designed to produce these outcomes. So the court system was never meant to bring justice for oppressed people, was never meant to bring justice for Black people. If you think we can go all the way back to the Dred Scott decision, right, that no Black person has any rights that any white person is bound to respect, right? And that's been the position of the courts. So for us to expect the courts to offer justice to Black people, for us to expect the courts to offer justice for oppressed people, is to deny the history of what this system has been and what it was built for. Even non-radicals are starting to call it the criminal legal system rather than the criminal justice system, recognizing that the system doesn't bring justice. It's just a legal system. And so I think it's really important that we think beyond courts and beyond these systems that weren't designed for us and how we usher in justice. It's the people who bring justice. And even if we think about how the court system might offer some semblance of justice, it's still not really justice, right? justice is much bigger. Even if we talked about how in Los Angeles County, 628 people have been killed by police, were killed by law enforcement under the former district attorney's watch, right? 628 people. Let's say we were able to get every single officer who was involved tried and prosecuted and actually sent to prison for those murders. That's still not justice. Justice would be that Redell Jones was still alive to raise her two children, right? Justice would be that 14-year-old Jesse Romero was taught by his very loving father and mother about why he shouldn't be tagging like every other 14-year-old child does. Not that he's a memory, right? These systems can't bring justice. These systems, this is why we have to take on an abolitionist approach, that it's the work outside the systems that actually brings justice. So we have to create meaningful reforms. I believe in meaningful reforms within the system, progressive reform within the system, but that is pending revolution. So in the Black Power movement, they used to have a term that they called survival pending revolution. So we want to get these systems to a point of Black survival, to a point of the survival of the oppressed, but we never want to stop imagining and building towards a fundamentally just system that preserves life, that nurtures communities rather than stealing from them.
I can't help but think, as you're speaking, you know, the demand that Moses could have brought to Pharaoh was reform Egypt. More days off for the slaves, better rations for the slaves, right? God demands that you be a little bit better than you were, but it's a much more revolutionary demand. It's a demand that says, bottom line, there is right and wrong, and my people need to be free.
That's right. That's right. And... you know, I had to mute myself because I have that Black tradition of call and response, and so it's very hard for me to listen to you speak and not and amen and bust into like laughter. Like you did not hear the loudness of my laughter. It's ridiculous. That would have been ridiculous, right? To say right. Better rations, and so we have to meet these same systems of injustice with that same kind of sense of ridiculousness. It's ridiculous to say, well, we want kinder, gentler slave catching, right? We want kinder, gentler caging of our people. No, we want abolition of these systems that are unjust, and we want freedom. We want liberation. We want our children. I mean, it's almost impossible. Every time I talk about Jesse Romero, I can't talk about him without crying. Because he was a 14-year-old child. You know, police killed a 14-year-old child. And then LAPD's answer to it is it was justified. It was in policy. So how can we say reform a system that says, I don't care what the circumstance is, that this system says the theft of a 14-year-old boy's life is justified, right? Yeah, that's a ridiculous notion. There is no circumstance under which a child's life can be stolen and we think it's okay.
There is no world in which the taking of a 14-year-old's life is okay. I want to ask Dr. Abdullah about exhaustion. The very end of this parsha, after Moses' first encounter with Pharaoh, Moses comes to Pharaoh, makes a demand. Pharaoh sends him away and increases the workload of the slaves. And the slaves, instead of coming to Pharaoh, come to Moses and say, how dare you make our lives harder? And it feels like, how could they not have that reaction after hundreds of years of oppression and hundreds of years of enslavement and murder? They can't see a different kind of a world. And so when somebody shows up with a message of liberation, it's met with suspicion and maybe even anger. And that feels like it just comes from a place of exhaustion and brokenheartedness. As you're telling these stories of children murdered, of people whose lives are taken away, how do you not succumb to exhaustion and hopelessness? How do people who are in the struggle for making things better not turn on one another? Help us understand that.
So let me begin by saying people will turn on one another. Not everybody will be grateful for your struggle or investment or sacrifice. And that's going to happen. We just have to accept that that's going to happen. We have to do all we can to build with folks, but that's going to happen. In Black Lives Matter, though, we were also really intentional about building what Dr. King calls a beautiful struggle. Anybody who's been, Raviv, you've been, it's fun. You know, we have, you know, of course we have the families talk and Jesse's father is there at almost all of our actions. You know, there's people who are in mourning and we mourn with them, but then we also turn on some music, right? And we also yell, you know, F the police. I don't know if you cuss on the show. I cuss a lot, so I'm trying to watch myself. But, you know, there's something restorative about, like, cussing out the people who are abusing your community members, right? And we also build beloved communities. So I'm going to say, give away a little secret, right? Like, after the Wednesday protests in front of the former DA's office, there's a whole team of us that come to my house and eat and watch a show called Lovecraft Country and play spades and drink beer. We intentionally build a movement that's not depleting, that's restorative. I think that there's going to be moments where you're tired, but because it's a restorative movement, because it's a movement where anybody who's been in BLM space knows that it's love. Like, we love each other genuinely, like from the truest space. And that keeps us from being burned out.
We have a few more minutes, and I'd like to take us back to that Heschel quote real quick and talk about your role in the educational space, where Heschel wrote, "As a rule, those who know how to exploit are endowed with the skill to justify their acts, while those who are easily exploited possess no skill in pleading their own cause." Due to your leadership, California recently made ethnic studies a graduation requirement at all Cal State universities. And I'm wondering if you can speak about the role of education in this equation of imbalanced justice, and what it was you were responding to.
I am the beneficiary of ethnic studies. I went to a high school, Berkeley High School, which was the only school in the country at the time with a Black Studies department. And for me, as a Black girl growing up in East Oakland at the height of the crack cocaine epidemic, Black studies really taught me something different about myself. And I'm the daughter of, you know, a teacher, right? Like, so I don't want to diminish who my mother is and who my grandmother, who I grew up across the street, my grandparents, who I grew up across the street from were. But the educational system and most of the systems that are built by white supremacy in this country tried to tell me who I was as a Black girl. And, you know, I was in and out of a lot of trouble. And it was Black studies that literally planted the seeds that would save my life. For me, I think about, like, who I could have been had this system, the exploiters that Heschel was talking about, had they won, versus the seeds that were planted by Black studies, which told me that I was someone else. And Black studies and ethnic studies more generally is the only set of disciplines that was built by community, not by the institution. So ethnic studies is really, in Black studies in particular, is the most enduring victory of the Black Power movement, right? That it was one of the demands that came out of the Black Power movement, that we had this liberatory model of education that's driven and grounded in community. And so as we think about the current era and really oppressed people generally, it's important that we have a way of study and a way of engaging in education that doesn't seek to isolate us from community, but understands that we are all constantly a part of the community that birthed us, and we have an obligation and a duty to that community. What we see in terms of how that pans out in higher education is students who take ethnic studies, especially students of color who take ethnic studies, do far better in terms of completing their education, but also then they carry back those tools that they've learned. And if they're in a class like mine, even as they're taking these classes, they engage in work that's meaningful to the community. So I also believe that education doesn't just belong to the individuals who are fortunate enough to participate in formal education, but it belongs to the whole of the community, and that's the approach that ethnic studies takes. So all of this is bound up together. It's because we understand that education is really supposed to be kind of a honing of intellectual tools that will help to transform the world under which we live.
There's so much food for thought here and deep wisdom that you've shared from the way that you frame this conversation, Dr. Adula, to your reflections on struggle and on joy and on empowerment. This is a wonderful way to start Exodus, and I'm so grateful for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. And the whole show, I keep hearing Bob Marley, right? Like, I can't say the word Exodus without singing Exodus. So y'all should play that. I don't know if you play music on this show, but, you know, I appreciate you for having me, and thank you for bringing me into this space.
We really appreciate your time. Dr. Gula, is there any parting message that you'd like to leave us with before we head out into Shabbat?
Yeah, I mean, as folks are meditating on their roles in this world and kind of their sacred duty, we hope that 2021 will be a year of continued and increased beautiful struggle. We want to encourage everybody to be involved in Black Lives Matter. People have said Black Lives Matter loudly over the last year. We need people to make Black Lives Matter. So we invite everyone to get involved in BLM. We also have a group that supports us called Clergy for Black Lives, and part of that is Jews for Black Lives. So we love folks to be involved in that work, and we look forward to struggling forward and ushering in greater justice in the coming year.
Dr. Adula, thank you so, so much for your time. It is a great honor to speak with you. And Rabbi Adam, thank you to all our listeners. Thanks for joining, and Shabbat Shalom. The Bible as an abolitionist document. I'd never thought about it that way. You know, since May, when Defund the Police started gaining attention, I was at first skeptical because I didn't quite understand what it meant. So I read as much as I could and showed up to protests where I knew I learned more from educators like Dr. Adula. I've had many arguments and debates over the terminology itself of defund. My father was concerned it would cost us the Senate, and we now know that's not true. The one person to run a defund campaign, Cori Bush, won her seat. And still the Democratic Party is wringing its hands over the concept of defunding the police. I guess, especially in the wake of everything we experienced the past 12 months, I just want to encourage those who remain reluctant about the phrasing and corresponding policies of defunding the police to continue to engage in critical thinking about this issue. And I hope that today's conversation, especially in the wake of this week's attempted police-enabled coup, helps make clear how dire the stakes are. As Dr. Abdullah said today, one of the reasons credited with this revolutionary moment in history is that we were on lockdown. We had the time to face our reality. And not to make it about Shabbat, but perhaps we could all use a day out of the week to stop for a moment, take a breath, and allow ourselves the space to consider the role of police and the judicial system in maintaining a power dynamic that allows for radical white supremacists to storm the Capitol building unharmed. We're going to link Dr. Abdullah's Twitter account on our own, @study_show, so that you can follow her amazing work. And we love hearing from you. In fact, through our Twitter page, listener Sean sent us an essay he wrote about his conversion process, in which he says that Here All Along, a book written by President Obama's senior speechwriter, Sarah Hurwitz, was a major inspiration during that time. And Sean, I'm excited to tell you that Sarah is going to be a guest here on the show in the coming weeks, so we have got you covered. The Study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host is Rabbi Adam Greenwald. Our guest today was Dr. Melina Abdullah. Artwork by Julia Pott. We'll see you next week.